You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, I think it's time to start, ladies and gentlemen. So let me warmly welcome you to this event here this morning at Brookings to launch in the United States our World Disasters Report 2012. My name is Matthias Schmaler. I'm an Undersecretary General working for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies based in Geneva. It's a particular honor to be here today because this is the 20th time that we are publishing this report. What is important for us in doing so on an annual basis is that while we as Federation of Red Cross, Red Crescent publish it, it's an independent report. We commission independent editors, and the editor of this year's report, Roger Zetter, whom I'll introduce in a minute, is with us, and the chapters are written up by researchers, experts in the subject matter, and it represents their opinions based on their research and knowledge. It's not a propaganda piece for the Red Cross, and we think that over the 20 years of publishing it, that has led to its credibility. It traditionally has two bits in it. The first one is to focus on a theme, and this year's is on forced migration and displacement, and I'll say a word or two on why we chose this theme in a minute. It also has a section of statistics trying to outline what the developments are in terms of disasters. And maybe allow me a word or two about what this year's report says in that respect, really two key messages. We're seeing fewer, or we saw in 2011 fewer disasters, natural and technological disasters. In fact, in terms of natural disasters, it was the lowest in a decade we saw. But they are getting more costly to deal with, both in terms of the damage they cause, if we think of the triple disaster in Japan, but also in terms of the response it takes. Logistics is getting more complex, more expensive. So there's messages in terms of disasters. That's why it's called the World Disasters Report. But then the main substance, obviously, is around the theme. And the reason we chose migration and forced migration and displacement include that this has been a topic on the humanitarian and the Red Cross, Red Crescent agenda for a number of years now. Every 4 years we have an international conference with governments who are signatory to the Geneva Conventions. And back in 2007, this was migration as such was one of the key issues and dealing with humanitarian concerns or consequences of migration. And we had some major commitments with governments on addressing humanitarian concerns. We brought it back to the agenda in 2011 last year, again trying to impress on governments that there are significant humanitarian concerns around migration, including forced migration. And we thus thought it was timely to make sure that this is an issue that doesn't disappear off the radar screens of governments and other decision and opinion makers, that we back up sort of our claims to governments with evidence. And that is what we think this report has done. And allow me two quick sort of key messages that stand out for me. One is the number of people affected. I think most people think still traditionally of refugees. As you will hear from Roger a bit later, the issue of forced migration is far more complex than just refugees. And in fact, we're looking at over 70 million people who are in forced migration. And another aspect that struck me in reading the report is that 20 of these 70 million or more are in protracted displacement, so a situation that requires longer-term solutions. But I'm not here to talk to you about the substance. My role here is to moderate this panel and then the discussion with you. And we are very honored to have three people join us here this morning. And let me introduce them quickly so that we can not have to do that later on in the discussion. I think Elizabeth Ferris sitting next to me probably needs no introduction since we're in her house, as it were. She's a senior fellow in foreign policy and co-director of the Brookings LSE project on internal displacement, as many of you will know. You will know that her work covers a wide range of issues, in fact, related to forced migration, human rights, humanitarian action. She's been in this business for a long time. I think one of your most recent jobs has been with the World Council of Churches for a number of years, Geneva-based, looking at various issues also around migration, but humanitarian and development in general. You've had a stint with the Church World Service here, Immigration and Refugee Program. You've been a research director at the Life and Peace Institute, and so on. I think your CV, impressive CV, is available, but just to give you a taste of that. Next to Beth is Carrie Santos from the American Red Cross, where she is responsible for expanding IHL dissemination programs and strengthening the engagement of the American Red Cross with the rest of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement. Again, Carrie has lots of relevant and impressive experience, including 10 years with the U.S. State Department Bureau for Population, Refugees, and Migration, and has a PhD in political science from the University of California in Berkeley, which I didn't know until I read your CV. And then last but not least, next to Carrie is Roger Zetter, who is this year's editor of the World Disasters Report. And we picked him because he is a known expert on the topic, and he can write and edit, obviously. He's an emeritus professor of refugee studies from the University of Oxford, where his last position till last year was director of the Refugee Studies Center. He's been a founding editor of the Journal of Refugee Studies from 1998 to 2001, holds a doctorate from the Institute of Development Studies, and again, numerous studies and publications related to this theme. So I hope I've whetted your appetite in listening to these three, as they will present the report and discuss specific aspects of it. So what we will do is we will start with Roger, who will give us a 15-minute or so summary of the report. I've heard him do it. It's impressive how he can summarize a 250-page report in 15 minutes. That will be followed by Beth, who will specifically look at development forced migration for a couple of minutes. And then finally, Carrie will look at this in terms of how the American Red Cross responds to displacement and forced migration in the context of disaster response. And then we'll open it up to you for questions, discussions, and hopefully some answers and views. Roger.
Matthias, thank you very much for that introduction. Good morning, everybody, and delighted to see so many of you here. Many thanks also to Beth and colleagues at Brookings for facilitating the US launch. Well, as Matthias said, my job, my challenge today is to summarize 250 pages in about 15 minutes. I'm just trying to do the mental arithmetic. It's probably about 20 or 30 pages a minute or something like that. So I'll try not to talk too fast, but really focus on the headlines of the report. It's certainly been a fantastic privilege to edit the report and, not surprisingly, quite a challenge as well. And I think one of the things that really attracted to the project to me, and Matthias mentioned this in the introduction, is really the kind of editorial freedom that I had. It is a report, as it were, for the International Federation of Red Cross, Red Crescent. It's not by them. And I think the kind of independence that I've had and the many authors that I've worked with, I think adds very immeasurably, really, to the credibility and the kind of integrity of the report. Matthias has said something about the genesis of the report in terms of the Red Cross movement, but I think sort of broadening, really, that introduction, I think the significance of the report themed on forced migration displacement can't be overestimated. I mean, as we speak in Syria, Mali, a really violent crisis, particularly in Syria, involving hundreds of thousands of refugees and IDPs. I just checked last night on the UNHCR website, and very roughly it looks as if there are about another 10,000 refugees a week coming from Syria at the moment. And alongside these contemporary crises, of course, are the protracted displacement of millions of people in the Horn of Africa, Colombia, Democratic Republic of Congo. And then another dimension, I think, is to think of the growing specter of land grabbing and land leasing in Africa and parts of Latin America, which is forcibly removing local farmers, local communities. And then again, one can think of climate change, where, again, I've been doing quite a lot of work, a slow-onset disaster which undermines livelihoods and, depending on the estimates you read, is going to force millions of people into vulnerable people into moving, migrating in the coming decades. That's a slow onset disaster, but one can think of the rapid onset disasters that are still getting on for 380,000 people displaced from the Haiti earthquake, living in essentially temporary shelter. And even just looking at the television last night and today, as you'll know, Hurricane Sandy in Jamaica, one of the headline features of that that disaster is displacement. So I think the evidence demonstrates that a disasters report focused on forced displacement is urgent, it's timely, and I think what we've tried to do is to present some pretty significant humanitarian challenges, but also to represent, I think, a very powerful voice for humanitarian actors. The kind of examples I've talked about, I think, compel attention because obviously from one perspective they signify destroyed livelihoods, human rights abuses, increasing vulnerability, loss of homelands, loss of histories, fractured cultures and communities. And obviously the human cost of forced migration is central, if you like, to the a central theme of the report. And it's a challenge, I think, that requires new thinking and decisive action, and the disasters report elaborates that. But it's not just the crisis experience, I think, and the vulnerability of forcibly displaced people that motivates the report, because I think one of the core precepts of the International Federation, and again very strongly, I hope, embedded in the report, is the notion of really the remarkable resilience and the capacities and the resources and the dignity of people, and I think above all the kind of human spirit of people captured in this incredible cover photograph, which I think is really a kind of sort of a counterintuitive representation of the challenges, if you like, of forced displacement, but also the kind of resilience of people in response to those situations, with obviously the support of the humanitarian community. The report covers a very wide range of issues, policies, priorities and recommendations. There are seven chapters which I've headlined here. There are 38 boxes, and I've just taken a sample of half a dozen or so there, 250 pages of main text. So my task today really is to try and just to highlight some of the key themes and some of the highlights of each chapter. Matthias, unfortunately, has stolen my sort of key punchlines, but I'll reiterate them nonetheless because I think they do merit a little bit of discussion. The key point, I think, is that we take a much broader perspective of forced migration displacement than just the classic refugee convention, the 10 million plus or minus refugees under the mandate of the High Commissioner for Refugees. Inevitably, the numbers are always going to be contested, and given a lot of caveats which are in the report, what we suggest is that there are, in 2011, nearly 73 million people were forcibly displaced. And the headline figure here, it sort of neatly but perhaps unfortunately resonates with a 1 in 100 of the world's citizens very roughly. But perhaps a more kind of dramatic or salient representation of that figure is that's roughly the size of the population of Turkey or the size of the population of the Democratic Republic of Congo if you were to aggregate, so to speak, the global number. But as the slide shows, a growing number of people are forced to migrate by a range of drivers, the refugee population, and then in addition to that, those displaced under the mandate of of UNRWA. And conflicts, violence, political upheaval, we're very familiar with that. That accounts for about 43 million people in 2011. Set alongside that is the figure of about 15 million for disaster displaced. And as Matthias has said, in the last year, that was actually a rather lower figure than the year before, where you had 6 million displaced in the Pakistan floods and obviously well over a million in the Haiti earthquake. Something that we felt was very important to introduce in the report was another category, if you like, or another label of forced migrants, and that's the 15 million people displaced by development each year, the building of dams, urban infrastructure, land grabbing, and so on and so forth. The figure is actually very hard to derive, and Beth is going to say more about that because she actually wrote Chapter 5 on which these data are based. So the scope is much wide. It's much wider than the kind of conventional understanding of force displacement. But I think it's significant nonetheless that we've got that scope. Turning now to some of the headlines from each of the chapters, one of the, I suppose, critical challenges for the humanitarian community is that the nature of force displacement, the drivers, the processes, are increasingly complex. And they're complex, I think, for two or three absolutely vital reasons. First of all, it's clear that force migration, particularly in relation to conflict, is increasingly unpredictable, and that has important implications for preparedness. Who, for example, would have thought that a riot in a Tunisian market, what was it, back in October 2010, would lead to the so-called Arab Spring, the Arab uprisings, and ultimately now a very violent civil war in Syria, for example. And it's the nature of the unpredictability of these crises which I think is a particular challenge for the humanitarian community. I think another characteristic is that although we can sort of simplify it and say, well, there are conflict refugees, there are disaster refugees, there are drought-affected refugees or displaced people, forcibly displaced people, the reality is that there are multiple and overlapping causes of displacement. One can think of the Horn of Africa, where obviously years of protracted violence and political fragility make households very vulnerable and precipitate forced migration, sometimes very locally, sometimes across borders. But that situation was compounded in 2010-2011, particularly by food insecurity and drought. And it's really the coming together of long-term conflict with perhaps a short or rapid onset disaster of drought, which then precipitated another wave of forced migration. Another, I think, critical challenge, and Matthias has already headlined this, is the very large number of people who are in prolonged or protracted displacement. We estimate this to be at least 20 million. Probably the figure is higher. But the nature of that protracted displacement, of lives in limbo, so to speak, of people with perhaps no clear future but integrating or settling perhaps in displacement situations in cities of Colombia, for example, in of IDPs, or refugees, long-term refugees in Kenya. The nature of the uncertainty of their lives and how the humanitarian community address those conditions of uncertainty, where there are no clear political solutions to that protractedness, I think is a major challenge. And then perhaps the greatest resistance, or the greatest challenge really, is the resistance of politicians and I think many citizens in the countries of the global north, the industrialized world, to supporting people who have been forced to flee their homes. And the report, I think, suggests quite powerfully that this is a major barrier to providing better humanitarian and longer-term support for very highly vulnerable populations. The second chapter is about vulnerability and protection. And protection, in other words, building safe and secure environments for people who are forcibly displaced or at risk of displacement, is obviously core to the IFRC's humanitarian support. And the report highlights ways in which the increasing complexity and unpredictability of forced migration crises, which I've outlined earlier, are making refugees and IDPs, and indeed those displaced by disasters, much more vulnerable. And these kind of conditions also diminish the scope for protection. What the report does, I think, is to stress two things. First of all, that livelihood support is absolutely crucial to reducing vulnerability, and it describes some of the policies and tools to achieve this. If livelihoods are threatened or if livelihoods are undermined, then vulnerability inevitably increases and protection quite likely diminishes. And on that second point, the report stresses the importance of community-based protection and the ways in which humanitarian actors can support community resilience. And we highlight in one of the boxes, for example, the work of the International Federation, the Red Cross and Red Crescent, in developing an approach to providing community-based safe spaces after the earthquake in Haiti. The third chapter deals with health on the move. On the one hand, this chapter notes that refugee camps, as we are very familiar, are a particular risk to health. But what the report does is to stress the need to ensure that urban environments where forced migration and forced migrants increasingly congregate, I'll say a bit more about this in a minute, but to ensure that they're not excluded from health systems and basic healthcare and medical services. And clearly, as opposed to camp-based displaced populations, it is much harder to access and identify forced migrants in an urban setting. So ensuring that strategic and operational priority for reproductive, maternal and child health is also emphasised in the report, together with a growing awareness of the need to respond to mental ill health and what one might call the kind of lifestyle and ageing diseases, because forcibly displaced communities, like all of us, are growing old, more susceptible to these life cycle diseases, and particularly those in protracted exile. The report highlights the need for medical and public health assistance and support to address these issues. A significant chapter deals with urbanisation, and the report highlights how, over the last decade, forced migration has urbanised. The majority of forcibly displaced populations, whether we're talking about refugees, IDPs, or disaster-affected populations, are now found in cities, towns, peri-urban areas, usually in informal settlements, not in the classic refugee camp. It's the main destination for populations impacted by these different dimensions, these different drivers of displacement. In addition, the report also highlights the fact that it's not just the humanitarian challenge of populations, displaced populations migrating to cities, but also the increasing phenomenon of intra-urban displacement. If one takes the example of Kenya, for example, post-election violence, 2007-2008 particularly, was a major driver of displacement of Kenyan citizens living in cities, and something the order of perhaps 500,000 people are still displaced, predominantly urban-based populations. And then obviously drug gangs, cartels, particularly in Latin American cities, are another major driver of intra-urban displacement. And these dramatic changes, I think, have very significant implications for humanitarian actors. What the report does is to highlight the way in which vulnerability analysis and humanitarian protection security can be improved, particularly through community-based tools in urban areas. The report stresses the importance of working with displaced populations, IDPs, host community groups, refugees, and so on. And it indicates the significance and describes ways of promoting economic activity amongst displaced people living in cities. And it also emphasizes a particular challenge, I think, for humanitarian actors more used to working in rural areas, the challenge of working in partnership with municipal authorities, the significant capacity in many countries of the Global South at a municipal and urban level, but also increasingly with private sector providers. Chapter 5 deals with development and forced displacement. Now, I'm not going to steal Beth's headlines here, but simply to introduce something that Beth is going to, I think, talk in a much more sort of articulate and much more detailed way, the need to really put back on the agenda development projects as the cause of forced displacement, what we call the hidden losers of the development process. And we pay particular attention, I think, to the responsibilities and roles of governments, but Beth will talk more about that. The chapter that provided me, I think, with the greatest challenge, but also the one that in many ways I was kind of keenest to put on the agenda of the report, is Chapter 6. And indeed one of the authors is here sitting in the front, and one of my mentors is sitting next to him from the World Bank, who's been provoking me for the last 2 years to work on the issue of a developmental framing, if you like, of what we characteristically think of as a humanitarian challenge. What the report does, and I think it's probably, I stand corrected on this, but I think it is the first time that there has been a comprehensive tracking of data on humanitarian funding for forcibly displaced people. Normally, it's embedded in sort of the wider discourse of development. But what we've done is to draw out various figures, something in the order of about $8.5 billion per annum from DAC countries. This doesn't include in-country, host country expenditure, for example. But we reckon that it's something in the order of about $8.5 billion a year of international assistance finds its way into programs and projects dealing with forcibly displaced populations. The second aspect of this chapter is to really address the question that has been addressed, I think, in many debates over the last few years, but never effectively answered, and that is that forced migration, as we know, produces very significant economic impacts and costs, not only for the displaced populations, but the host communities, their governments, and, of course, humanitarian actors and donors, hence the figure here. And it's always the negative impacts and the economic and financial costs, the so-called refugee burden, that are the focus of the concern, but of humanitarian concern, and understandably so. But what the report does is to call for much greater efforts to minimise these negative impacts and maximise the productive opportunities which refugees can provide. And to this end, the report shows how greater synergy between humanitarian and development actors can promote policies that capitalise on the economic potential and the need to integrate displaced populations into the local economy. And the report promotes ways of tackling livelihood support through, for example, cash and vouchers and writing down risks. These are now gradually finding their way into humanitarian and development assistance related to displaced populations, but what the report tries to do is to give this new strategy, so to speak, a much greater push. Because it's in this way that incomes can be sustained and greater financial independence can be achieved. In effect, sustainable solutions occur when humanitarian interventions meet development agendas, and that really is the kind of theme of this chapter, I think, and the importance of humanitarian and development actors working together with the private sector is also emphasised in the report. For example, supporting micro-enterprise, encouraging small businesses, supporting local farmers, and helping local communities and entrepreneurs benefit from the increased demand that comes from displaced populations for food, building materials for shelter, consumer goods, and so on and so forth. The last chapter deals with four main topics, and really I'm just sort of highlighting one, and the last chapter is really about the continuing challenges, as if the previous six chapters were not about challenges, but really trying to sort of flesh out some of the kind of emerging challenges and some of the themes that are perhaps dealt with rather briefly elsewhere in the report. One part of Chapter 7 deals very much with the governance of the humanitarian regime. The section that I particularly want to draw on is a section which deals, which we've titled Unlocking Protracted Displacement. I've already highlighted the figure, something the order of 20 million people living in protracted displacement. I mean, the construction of that term is rather artificial, but we're talking probably a minimum of 5 years, sometimes 20 years, sometimes generations. What the report does, I think, in this particular part of the so I've just lost my notes on this one. But what it does is to try to draw out the fact that not only do we need to look at developmental responses, because after all we're dealing with populations that have settled, they've perhaps integrated at least informally in new locations, either in new countries or perhaps in new locations in countries where they've been displaced. And I think promoting developmental responses is a much more economically sustainable way and better protects the rights and dignity of those who have been forcibly displaced. But what the report also does, and I think it really challenges, I think, a lot of the political leadership and a lot of the political thinking about protracted displacement and how we need to unlock some of the kind of political barriers to protracted displacement. And that is really ensuring that displaced people have the right to work, which is, in many countries, in fact, sort of rarely possible, at least officially. More freedom of movement, more liberal approaches to cross-border mobility. We know, for example, that Iraqi refugees in Syria, at least until the present crisis, were moving backwards and forwards across the border. Were they refugees in protracted displacement, or were they people seeking ways to go home? And exactly the same with Somali displaced population. So to conclude, really, I think in tackling protracted displacement and many of the other humanitarian challenges of forced migration, the difficulty lies, as we say towards the end of the report, not in developing new ideas but escaping the old ones. And I think this is why the WDR for this year is so timely and such a powerful call to action for donors and humanitarian and development actors and the international community, I think, to adopt the policies, the strategies, the tools that are elaborated in the report. And the purpose, I think, is to reinforce recognition of the rights of forced migrants and to help them become productive members of the communities in which they reside and not just simply social pariahs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roger. I think you've already introduced what Beth is going to do as author of Chapter 5, which is to look particularly at the development-induced forced migration.
Thank you. But first of all, just a word of congratulations to Roger for putting this all together. You know, he was working with 50 different writers in a very short time frame. It's an amazing accomplishment. I can't imagine still smiling after that after that experience. I'm going to talk about the chapter I wrote, which is on this issue of development-induced displacement. But let me say that as somebody from a humanitarian background, this was really unusual to see humanitarians grappling with this issue. We live in very separate universes with different languages and cultures and time frames and ways of interacting with each other, and just crossing this divide between the humanitarian community and the development community, I think, is a real accomplishment. The first time I met somebody about 5 years ago who said to me, "Yes, I work on resettlement." All I could think about was refugee resettlement, which I'd worked on before as well. And I was shocked to find out that there is a tremendous community of people who work on resettlement in the context of development projects. And so it is unusual for humanitarians to address this. And I think the subtitle of this chapter, Hidden Losers of the Forgotten Agenda, is really quite interesting. One of the challenges of working on this issue is that the term development-induced displacement includes quite a variety of different situations, from large-scale infrastructure projects to nature preserves to urban renewal to displacement of hundreds of thousands of people to 20 or 30 families, sporting events, cleaning up for the Olympics often means displacing people. So this term encompasses a wide variety of situations, making generalization somewhat difficult. But in looking at this universe of people displaced by development projects and comparing it with people displaced by conflict or violence in one form or another, there are several striking differences. First, and often when people are displaced by conflict, you get both internally displaced persons and you get refugees, people who have left the country. Almost all, I think, all of development-induced displacement is internal. The patterns of responsibility are different. It is the state that is responsible for displacing people, for making sure that they are cared for in a way that isn't so obvious often with conflict situations. It was hard, for example, to hold the Somali government accountable for displacement that occurred the past year when some of it was carried out by armed actors like al-Shabaab, others by the drought. But in the case of development-induced displacement, it is a state responsibility, either for the actual conditions in which people are forced to move or for regulating the actions of private enterprise in their actions which displace people. It is planned. You know, for those of us working on the humanitarian side, you respond to the movements of people. The luxury, as it seems from humanitarians, of having time to plan who's going to move and how and under what conditions and what do they need and how to involve the community is a different dynamic to this kind of displacement. While most displacement by conflict is usually assumed, at least in the beginning, to be temporary, the assumption with development-induced displacement is that it will be permanent. This is a different dynamic. Now, in fact, we know from the description of the protracted displacement we see in many or most of the world's situations, sometimes it isn't temporary. You know, maybe people fleeing Syria right now won't be able to go home in the next year or the next 5 years, as the fact that Iraqi refugees who have still been displaced for many years. But the assumption that it's going to be permanent also gives more responsibility to get it right. Another difference is that development is a positive thing. It's good for countries to develop their energy resources and come up with better sanitation systems and construct new housing for people. Development is a positive goal as compared with conflict, which is a negative one. People have a right to development, and they also have a right to not be arbitrarily displaced. Most governments have provisions in their political systems to allow people to be moved against their will for a greater public good. And sorting out what that is and what some of the motivations might be is sometimes complicated. Sometimes the government will say, we're moving you for your own protection, to keep you safe from floods or landslides. But sometimes there are other interests that intersect with those altruistic ones of protecting people. And the final difference with those displaced with conflict is that humanitarian actors are rarely involved. When people are displaced by a dam, for example, it's rarely the same kinds of actors who are responding as those displaced by conflict. Roger mentioned the statistic of 15 million people a year displaced by development projects. That's the best estimate we have. I mean, but it's certainly incomplete. Nobody is really keeping track of how many are displaced by this wide variety of different kinds of development projects. I suspect there's nobody in the United States who's keeping track of how many Americans are displaced by the whole gamut of different projects going on. Sometimes, too, we think that those who are displaced by development projects, as those displaced by disasters, may be those who are living in the most vulnerable situations, the squatters, the renters, living on marginal land, easier to displace those kinds of people than the wealthy. So that may make it also difficult to collect accurate statistics. The box in the chapter on India, written by the Calcutta Research Group, estimates that in the last 50 years, between 21 and 40 million people were displaced by development projects in India alone. Now, that's quite a range. It averages out to be 400 to 800,000 people a year, but some indication of the scope of this. Now, the term of choice in this community is development, forest displacement, and resettlement. And resettlement is more than just physically moving people. It's enabling the restoration of livelihoods and access to services. And it's a process of participation of communities in deciding how their new community will be structured. The World Bank has played the leadership role in developing safeguard policies to make sure that people who are moved do not experience a deterioration in their standard of living. And the basic principles are, try not to resettle anyone, try not to displace anyone, but if you have to, minimize it and make sure that people are at least as well off as they were before the displacement occurred. Those are the basic standards which have been incorporated by many of the multilateral development banks as guidance. And they provide a lot of very useful information on how this actually is carried out in practice. Overall, I think most researchers would say most people who are displaced by development projects are not better off. And there are hundreds or thousands of examples of how this has been done poorly. But there are also examples where it's been done well, where, in fact, communities have been enabled to develop even as a result of their displacement. I think there's much to learn from some of these examples. When I think of things that humanitarian actors can learn from this experience of development, forest displacement, and resettlement, you see humanitarians working more and more on issues of compensation, housing, land, and property issues, where the experiences with development-induced displacement have a lot to offer in determining how you compensate people. Restoration of livelihoods is another area where development-induced displacement and resettlement has much to teach us. Sometimes, too, people displaced by development projects, there's a relationship with conflict. People can get angry, and protests can lead to government crackdowns. And so the dividing line between those displaced by development and conflict perhaps isn't so clear. Increasingly, we're seeing that resettlement may be used as a solution in other kinds of situations, particularly in disasters. Montserrat, for example, the eruption of a volcano in 1995 meant that people had to be permanently resettled as a solution to that situation. We're seeing similar things in Japan as a result of the nuclear accident, that people may not ever be able to go back to their communities. And so learning from some of these experiences can be helpful. Perhaps most importantly, those displaced by development projects often have similar needs to those displaced by conflict. needs for shelter, most obviously, but to restore jobs and get access to services, and the individual trauma that is experienced by people can actually be quite similar. For many local organizations in particular, they're working in the same areas of people displaced by conflict and by development projects, and therefore it's natural for them to want to respond. And there I think the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement is perhaps unique in having, you know, feet in both camps, if you will, in many different situations. So I commend you for including this, Roger. It presents a lot of challenges for those of us trying to bridge this chasm, it sometimes feels like, between humanitarian and development actors. But I think this is a great start. Thanks.
Thank you. A triple thank you to you, Beth, for what you've just said, for writing a chapter, and for bringing about this event. And without further ado, over to Carrie for a national organization's perspective.
Sure. I really have the privilege of going after our two scholars here who've presented this excellent global overview for the year, and I don't need to compete with that. Luckily, I get to go from the global to the local, from the macro to the individual, and talk about the human face of some of the statistics that we've been hearing about and a few individual cases even. I also would like to talk about the difference between humanitarian, that's so kind to point out the language we use, and humanity. Humanitarian is about us, the work we do, what we do, and humanity is actually about our clients, our beneficiaries, if we use jargon, but it's better not to use jargon. Humanity means everyone. It means we don't make distinctions between those people using a service and those people providing a service. That's what we do at American Red Cross. Our work reconnecting families is through a program we call Restoring Family Links, and it's a program about individuals. Each and every individual is a huge priority for us. It's personal work. We rely on trained social workers to ensure that each person is helped as much as possible when we're connecting them with their loved ones. We see them as whole human beings with emotional needs and fears. And when we're lucky and we have a positive outcome and we find their family members, we get to witness these individuals' overwhelming happiness. We see the whole range of humanity and human emotions in our work. Humanitarians don't just assist the forced migrants in camps and deliver them water and food according to sphere standards, as important and essential as all of those things are. We know that we are human beings whose psyches and emotions play a huge role in our survival. We always need more than food and shelter. Someone on my team recently put it in a new way to me. If people are to thrive and build their new lives after terrible disruption of displacement, their connections to their family are essential. People need their emotional support networks. We've always known that emotional well-being plays a huge role in recovery and resilience, and we can build psychosocial programs and improve coping mechanisms. But you can also address the root causes of the trauma and help the forcibly displaced rebuild their family and social networks. And that's what we mean by reconnecting families. Today I'm going to tell you how we do this in the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, and specifically here at American Red Cross, we're pleased to offer the service in the United States. But I'm not pitching our specific program. I have a broader agenda. I'm not forced to talk simply about this year. I can go back a little bit in history and remind us about the beginnings of humanitarian work in the mid-19th century. Our own Clara Barton, the founder of American Red Cross, is most well known for ensuring that soldiers on the battlefield received medical care, getting supplies to the wounded and sick. But how many of you knew that she also worked day and night to discover the fate of missing soldiers? She helped wounded soldiers write their last letters home to their families. When Clara Barton returned to Washington, D.C. at the end of the Civil War, even before she knew what the Red Cross movement was and how it was getting off the ground in Europe, she set up the Missing Soldiers Office right here on 7th and E Streets Northwest, a block and a half from the Verizon Center. After the war ended, she worked for years helping families to find out what had happened to their lost sons, husbands, and fathers. Between 1865 and 1868, when the office closed, she'd been able to identify the fates of over 22,000 men. And in that time, her team was responding to requests from 65,000 families. She knew this was essential. She understood that this was at the heart of humanitarianism, of bringing humanity into the most brutal of situations. And this is the tradition we're very proud to carry on today. We have many partners. This is not exclusive to the Red Cross and Red Crescent. We work with organizations that specialize helping unaccompanied minors, elderly, disabled. But we all work together knowing that humans need these emotional connections to thrive. Behind each statistic is a family who is worried or grieving, an individual. In the U.S., our main clients for family tracing and connections come from the major conflicts of our time, Liberia, Somalia, Iraq, Democratic Republic of Congo. But you will also find some surprising other conflicts on our list of current clients: the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, World War II. We continue to reconnect families who have been separated after 50 or 60 years. These are enduring needs that linger long after a person has had their basic needs satisfied, even after they've built entirely new lives. Each person wants closure, and in our successful cases, when they are able to actually locate their loved ones, they are able to show that adversity didn't carry the day. They were able to overcome those who turned their lives upside down, and they were able to preserve their family ties. These stories show that there is always hope. And we live in a country of immigrants in the U.S. It's well known. We are not so much a country of first asylum, but we have many people living right next door from us who left their homes quickly and were not able to keep their families intact as they were forced to focus on their own immediate survival. Today, luckily, we're not using the newspapers and letters as Clara Barton did, but we have tools that are helping us. Technology is playing a huge role. We use cell phones, internet, Facebook, Twitter. It makes it much easier to locate families in a few minutes, in a few hours or days. After a natural disaster, you find that the Red Cross and Red Crescent set up satellite links as quickly as possible to enable people to make cell phone calls or go on the internet. And in this way, family connections are not broken in the first place. We're able to prevent it and keep families intact. But of course, there are still tough cases, those whose circumstances don't make it possible for a simple cell phone call to do the trick. I'll give you an example from Haiti. Like many other families, the home of baby Jenny was destroyed after the earthquake in January 2010. Her mother was injured and taken to the hospital, and her father followed her mother, and baby Jenny was not immediately found. When her parents returned to search for her days later, they learned from their neighbors that baby Jenny had been discovered, but badly injured and taken away by rescue workers, the humanitarians. The parents were, of course, desperate to find out what had happened to their daughter, and they went to the Red Cross. We at American Red Cross were able to determine that baby Jenny had been evacuated to Florida for medical treatment. The Red Cross helped locate baby Jenny in the hospital and then worked with her parents to validate the relationship to make sure we were not mistreating her, making sure she's going back to her actual parents. And then after a couple of weeks, they were all reunited. That's the kind of story that happens every day around the world. And at American Red Cross, we provide the same service whether a person was separated by natural disaster or displaced by an armed conflict. It makes absolutely no difference to us. It's one of those areas where the connections between natural disaster and armed conflict are very clear. We do the same work. The Haiti case was a very immediate example, and we were quickly able to bring baby Jenny back to her parents. But it's important to know that even after 5 or 6 decades of families being separated, they still want to rebuild their bonds of love, and that is really what does make us human. As humanitarians, we think our job is done when a durable solution is found for those who are forcibly displaced. They find a country that allows them to work and live in security. They get to return home. That's great. It's a success story. We cross them off our list. But at Restoring Family Links, we look at another angle entirely. Individuals come to terms with what has happened to them and their loved ones and to their former lives over quite a long time. They may have a series of basic and existential questions they feel compelled to answer. What happened to my grandmother? What happened to my cousin or my sister? So here's an example from World War II. Alfreda's family was torn apart by the Holocaust. She was a teenager and her mother died. Her younger siblings were taken in by an aunt and she was left to fend for herself. Eventually, Alfreda was one of the lucky ones. She survived, married an American man, moved to the U.S. in 1955, but she never learned what had happened to her siblings. Through the Red Cross, she found the answers. One of her brothers was still alive and located by the Red Cross in Berlin. The two were able to reunite and catch up on their lives after 65 years of separation. We can't underestimate the importance of reclaimed family members. Even if a person's home and livelihood were destroyed, when we reconnect families, an important piece of their former lives, perhaps the most important piece of their former lives, is restored. And when we do not have the happy cases, when all we're able to do is to search, we may not find out ever what happened, we still believe that documenting what has happened, memorializing the details, as we do in our casework, plays a key role in recognizing the importance of each and every individual who has died as a result of an armed conflict or some other tragedy. Each person deserves to have their story investigated as far down the road as we can go. This is really what humanity is about. We've seen this with the 46,000 Holocaust cases that we have handled since the 1990s. It was in the 1990s that the World War II archives beyond the Iron Curtain first became open and available for searches. We've been able to find information in roughly half of those 46,000 cases. And for a lucky 1,600 individuals, not only did we find out information about their loved ones, but they were able to find living family members and reconnected, as in the case of Alfreda. One last point I'd like to make today is the overall point of my talk. Forced displacement is not something that happens over there to those people. It happens to your neighbors. Wherever you live, you have neighbors who were forcibly displaced, whose parents or grandparents were forcibly displaced by conflict. At the Red Cross, we have some 2,000 people each year who are still seeking closure, still seeking information, even though they presumably are moving on with their lives. They may not stop searching. They want closure. They want to document what has happened. This process of an individual telling his story is essential, and that is really what we mean by the principle of humanity that's so dear to us at the Red Cross. It's confronting the complete and whole person. This notion of humanity inspires our work every day. We look at a person's emotional needs, symbolic needs, ceremonial needs, and that is really how we are fulfilling our mission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carrie, for bringing not just a national and local perspective, but reminding us of the human face to the figures and overall tendencies we are looking at. Now the floor is yours. We have about 35 minutes or so for engagement with you, comments, questions you may have. I think we have roving microphones, so let's maybe start at the back there and come forward.
Is it okay if I sit, or do you want me to stand?
Please.
Okay, thank you. I have maybe a general observation, and it could be either for Professor Zetter or for Beth. It's to look at gaps. I think, Beth, when you first mentioned the challenge of going from humanitarian to development made me think about that. So practically speaking, looking at funding, for instance, I think we also have a problem of siloed money. And I just wondered, Professor Zetter, since I haven't had a chance to read the chapter, maybe this is an easy question, whether you had a chance to take a look at how do we make that seamless journey from humanitarian funding to development funding to have that sustainable response. I look at the way the U.S. government is structured. You either have PRM or FDA, or you have aid. And then if you go multilaterally, you have UNHCR, UNICEF, or you have UNDP. But there isn't a seamless system to ensure sustainability of the response, and that's going to be critical, especially for the protracted situations which have stopped really being humanitarian. So I just wondered if you could respond on that gap. And the second gap question is on this promotion of the private sector as a potential partner. From my own agency's experience, and let me just use the example of what we're seeing in Turkey. The Turkish government has responded with containers as the housing solution. The photos I've seen, and I've asked my colleagues to clarify, is the containers sit flat on the ground. They're punishingly hot in the heat and probably going to be very cold as they move into the cold season. It is certainly a solution, but it's going to be a solution that's going to become a permanent solution. And based on what we saw with Katrina, there's a lot of health potential if this becomes protracted. So how do we engage with private sector to not erode the humanitarian standards we have regarding what constitutes adequate humanitarian response, because they're used to a different way of operating. Thank you.
May I ask actually for people to introduce themselves also?
I'm sorry. My name is Daisy Francis. I'm the Protection Advisor at Catholic Relief Services.
Thank you very much. And we'll take three, four, if that's okay for you to gather questions. Let's move the microphone further to the front here.
Thanks. Mike O'Brien from the American Refugee Committee. Thank you for the report. It's a powerful representation of the forced migration, its relationship to development, its impact on the human condition. Looking specifically at the chapter on health, we can see forced migration has major impacts as it disrupts health systems, specifically continuity of care, treatment for TB, HIV, maternal health, child health, vaccinations. Any thoughts on how to use this to inform the new Millennium Development Goals and what we can do to maybe make sure that's included? Thanks.
Thank you. Maybe this side of the room, one up.
Thank you, Patricia Fagan, Georgetown University, and much along the same lines of the previous questions. Both Roger and Beth have talked about the challenge to the humanitarian community to achieve what are essentially or always have been seen as development goals, housing and livelihoods and compensation. Some of them are humanitarian goals too, but the humanitarian agencies are rarely around long enough to do them. And I totally agree with Daisy Francis that the funding doesn't make it easier, it makes it much harder because it's siloed and short term. So, but I wonder if the two of you would might think, what would you advise humanitarian agencies to do for retooling? I mean, everybody, there's not much controversy about the challenge, but there's a lot of difficulty in meeting the challenge, and how could humanitarian agencies better retool given present funding limitations? Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe one final one in this first round, and then I'll get to the rest just right next to you.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Friedman. I'm a reporter with Climate Wire. We're an energy policy magazine here. This is a great report. I'm curious, you know, we've been hearing and reading for quite some time, and in this report too, that climate change is going to increase disasters and by extension forced migration. Can any of you say with any degree of certainty on your, you know, 20th anniversary of doing this report, what impact, if any, you've seen from climate change so far? Is that something that is known, can be known? Thanks.
Thank you. Let me turn to the panel, and then we'll get back to you. I don't know, Beth, you want to start, or Roger?
Roger?
Thank you. Some really challenging and very stimulating questions. Thank you so much. I think we may not have time for another round, actually. I'll try and be brief. To go straight to the heart of the humanitarian development divide or nexus, depending on where you're coming from. What the report says about it and indeed what I think about it. Let me start by actually not the thrust of your question about the funding streams and the governance, if you like, of development and the governance of humanitarianism, which are problematic. I'll come to that. But let me actually start from really the other end of the spectrum. What do displaced people do? What are their immediate responses after the sort of very basic life-saving interventions have taken place, if that's appropriate? They drive a development agenda, even in temporary displacement, let alone refugees from Somalia who've been displaced and living in Nairobi for 10, 15, 20 years, who've developed their own micro, and some would say macro economy there. So I think we just have to really look at, development comes from below, even in what we label as humanitarian contexts. And I think in terms of sort of echoing Patricia's point or sort of picking on that, the kind of retooling, I alluded to that, I think, in my presentation, looking at risk and insurance, looking at cash and vouchers. In other words, looking at direct ways in which you can inject money, basically, into the local economy, into the hands of displaced people, and letting them make the choices of how they want to if you like, spend that money, how they want to utilize humanitarian assistance, humanitarian support. And I think that's absolutely vital. And I think, you know, I mean, it's really echoing Kerry's point. I mean, we just have to look at the humanity. We have to look at human beings and what they do, even in these incredibly adverse circumstances. And I think the reality of that is it's not just a different way of looking at humanitarian needs and responses, but it is actually a way in which it potentially is a win-win situation, because not only does it give more autonomy and independence to those people who are being supported by humanitarian agencies, but it actually feeds into the local economy of the host communities as well. People need food, they buy food from local farmers. People need building materials for shelter, they buy it from local contractors. People need basic household commodities. Okay, it takes the time to acquire the capital to do that, particularly if you're displaced, but that can stimulate local production. So in that sense, it seems to me that one way of looking at the problematic is to actually think local. Let me come back to the bigger global picture. Unlocking the kind of the silos, as you put it, I think is prodigiously difficult. We have seen some initiatives, and we talk in the report about the Transitional Solutions Initiative, which was a link-up between UNHCR, UNDP, and the World Bank. And I can see from nodding you're familiar with it, and I guess many people in the room are. But that was an attempt to try and sort of break out of the silos and to recognize that, even as the UNHCR itself says, that many humanitarian situations and many situations of population displacement cannot only or cannot even be addressed by humanitarian principles, practices, and so on. We have to look at developmental opportunities. It is a challenge, but I think we can begin to see the kind of shift of the agenda. And that shift, I think, interestingly enough, is not coming primarily from the big international players in this framework, despite what I've said about the Transitional Solutions Initiative. It is coming from the International Federation. It is coming from Red Cross societies. It is coming from the NGO community, who are working with people and seeing what people themselves are doing on the ground and how they want to restore and reconstruct their livelihoods. And from their livelihoods, reconstruct, obviously, the household budget and their own autonomy and independence. So it is, I think, and why I think this chapter is important, I think it does really put this agenda and this challenge right centrally, I think, in the field of humanitarian discourse and particularly international intergovernmental agencies. The private sector, again, I think, is a major challenge, but again, I think there's a kind of resistance, I guess, in many of the humanitarian actors, and I think there's a kind of resistance of many of us who come with kind of humanitarian precepts and a kind of a welfare, if you like, perspective on these challenges. But it does seem to me that the private sector can unlock new resources, both at an international level. One only has to look at the support by ICAO for the UNHCR, for example. I mean, it sort of challenges a lot of the kind of precepts and a lot of the kind of concepts that and the position that we come from. But I think with absolutely critical safeguards, and I think this is why the humanitarian actors are so powerful in this field, that they can, I think, if you will, demarcate absolutely critical lines of standards. No matter who's providing the humanitarian support, they have to. And I think their important role is partly facilitating perhaps engagement in the private sector, but also, if you like, defining very clearly the terms of engagement and the absolutely critical precepts that must govern these new funding streams. If I could say a little bit about climate change, I've come to the last one, I mean, partly because it's a section of the report I wrote and it's where I've been doing a lot of research. I think there are two points I'd make. First of all, I think whereas 10 years ago, a lot of the thinking, both the sort of academic thinking and the policy thinking, was that the climate change is going to drive 50, 200 million people by 2050. This is the figure that was created by
He was an Oxford academic, I'm sorry to say, Norman Myers, and that figure has just been recycled over the decades on a very, very flaky methodology. I think what we now recognise is that except in very exceptional circumstances of clearly rising sea levels, for example, climate change of itself is not necessarily a driver. It certainly stresses environments, it does make households more vulnerable, but usually in the context of other kinds of vulnerabilities, where, for example, rights are not protected, other kinds of household vulnerabilities, where people have no political power and cannot sort of represent themselves, where there are resettlement policies, for example, in a country like Vietnam, where very large-scale resettlement is taking place from the most flood-prone areas of the Mekong Delta, for example. So I think the first point to make is that climate change of itself is only a driver of displacement in the context of many other social and economic variables at a local level and also at a macro level. I think the other point to make is that whereas very often migration is seen as a kind of the failure, if you like, and is seen as the kind of negative consequence of climate change or maybe other drivers of migration, migration, if it is properly managed, can be a very positive adaptation strategy. And I think the challenge for the humanitarian community, again, is to think of these kind of slow-onset disaster situations, disaster equals humanitarian, is to actually think of these kind of slow-onset situations as a developmental challenge, as much as it is an immediate humanitarian challenge of protection of rights, addressing vulnerabilities, and so on and so forth.
Beth?
Maybe just a few comments. First, to pick up on this climate change and displacement, it also has implications for these planned relocations, and certainly there are lessons to be learned from our experience in other contexts. In the Arctic right now, for example, in Alaska, there are communities that have to move now. It isn't something 10 or 20 years, or small indigenous communities, the erosion, the melting of the permafrost, and so it's just it's happening now. So I think that, you know, we really need to be prepared for how to make this process as humane and as respectful of human rights as possible. I think there are also some very good initiatives between the humanitarian and development communities. This focus on the word or concept of resilience, for example, is one that can draw from the strengths of both. I think a lot of the work that's being done now on housing, land, and property issues from both humanitarians and development, they need each other. You know, sometimes it's just a question of the language that's used. Sometimes I feel like writing something, a guidebook for development actors using your language about humanitarian issues. You know, some kind of translation of some of these concepts might be helpful. I was really intrigued by your comment about health and the Millennium Development Goals and thinking about what's going to come next after 2015, and is there any way for displacement-related issues to enter into that process? I think it would be a sign of real progress if there were an acknowledgement of the development consequences of displacement. It's something certainly to work on.
Thank you. Let's do another round. I will move this time from the front to the back, and I will come to you at the back. Let's move here to this gentleman.
Thank you. Very interesting discussion. I'm Luca Dall'Oglio from the International Organization for Migration, IOM. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the link between slum dwellers and urban displaced, because it seems to me that this is a critical issue given the growth of the slum dwellers population in general in developing countries and the characteristic of urban displacement, and therefore the link between humanitarian and the need to maintain humanitarian interventions might be challenged by a perceived need to address developmental approach. And in general, I think the need of urban renewal, including possibly those kind of planned phased migration and adaptation strategies, but I think is a very complex and daunting issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Now the gentleman at the very back, and then we'll come back to the front.
Thank you. Robert Chiretta, President of International Investor, and speaking for the private sector, let me vent a little frustration here. I haven't heard anything in this discussion about the effectiveness of these programs. You know, we've already seen a couple of instances. I'll be brief here. We've seen instances where corporate contributions and participation have been a terrific help in some instances, but the potential is vast and unrealized because even in the most altruistic corporations and motives, they have to report to a board of directors that at the end of the day, it's not just good PR, but that there was some effectiveness from the contributions made. So my question is this. Is there any follow-up delivered here in terms of measuring the effectiveness of your programs? Do you make any effort to survey those that have been assisted, for example, so that they can respond a year or two later and report? I'd like to see an independent, you know, survey done by an agency that would suggest how much, in fact, the assistance has been helpful to them or where it's been weakest.
Thank you. Lady in the front here.
I'm Rotan Chanti with the Baptist World Aid. Thank you for your presentation. It's been very good. It's a question I have in my mind. It's maybe since this is we're talking about humanitarian, but we haven't really talked about the other vulnerable population that don't have a face, thinking of nature or animals, biodiversity. How does development, introduction of development in these places, the need for biodiversity, the loss of biodiversity among indigenous communities, how can development humanitarian agencies work with those kinds of issues, partnering with conservation societies, etc.? Is that something, and it relates to, of course, climate change as well, if you would address that. Thank you.
Thank you. Lady in the fourth row there, if possible. And then I'll turn it back to the panel, and we might be able to squeeze in one or two more rounds.
Hi, I'm Abby Brohl with Interaction. I just wanted to pick up on the idea of resilience, which has seemed to kind of take a life of its own lately, and it just seems to be an idea rather than anything behind it. So I was just wondering, one, how do we operationalize and programatize this idea of resilience, and how do we ensure that resilience isn't used as a means to replace humanitarian action or to defund humanitarian response?
Thank you. Back to the podium. Who's going to volunteer this time? I think, Roger, we're looking at you.
Okay. Let me start with the second question, I think, from Robert. In terms of the kind of follow-up and the evaluation of impact of humanitarian programs and interventions, there is an enormous industry, one might almost say. Every project, every program is micro-analyzed and sort of poured over. And I don't know of a single program or project which isn't evaluated in some way or another. And I guess there are probably quite a few people in the room, including myself, who've done these kind of evaluations for Oxfam or what have you. So there is an enormous kind of capacity and investment in program evaluation. But I think one of the gaps in a lot of that evaluation is that, on the one hand, we've not really had, and this may seem surprising, the effective kind of methodologies to do a really rigorous economic and fiscal evaluation of these projects. The evaluations, to the extent they take place, cover a kind of a very broad range of kind of social and socioeconomic impacts, but not the kind of evaluation that you would do as a corporate director of kind of rates of return. And to be provocative, I mean, that $8.4 billion per annum that I talked about, I mean, one of the headlines that I put in the sort of the introduction to that chapter is that no corporate enterprise would get away with that level of expenditure without some kind of very detailed fiscal and broader economic impact evaluation. Yet, in effect, that doesn't really take place, I think, within the humanitarian frame. So you're right in a way that I think a more effective engagement of the corporate sector would demand and would benefit from a much clearer
framing, if you like, of evaluations around the sort of the economic and the fiscal. And the problem, as I say, until recently, is that the tools that drill down and provide that focus, I don't think have existed. But there is work that we're doing, I've been doing with the World Bank, really to try and develop methodologies that look at those kinds of questions in a more rigorous and a more systematic way. Perhaps I'll come back to some of the other questions in a minute, Beth. I would like to talk about the first question on slum dwellers and displaced, but Beth, happy for you to take a first shot at that.
I think that Haiti really brought those issues to the fore for the humanitarians. What's the relationship between the generalized urban poor and people who've been displaced? And even questions about defining displacement. If your house fell down and you're sleeping in the yard, are you displaced? Or if you move a block away, and are there programs intended to help displace, which may be actually contributing to displacement by offering services and in camps, for example, and drawing people. I think there are a lot of questions around how we distinguish particular vulnerabilities. It seems to be the case, particularly in urban settings, that as poor people move to cities, they live on increasingly marginal land, therefore more vulnerable and susceptible to disaster. So there are multiple connections, if you will. You know, urban violence or sometimes occurring in slums is also can be a driver of displacement. I think it's an issue that's really that sees the humanitarian community because of the experience of Haiti, and still lots of unresolved questions. In terms of your question about the relationship of humanitarian action to environmental concerns, I think it's fair to say that this is an issue that more and more humanitarians are concerned about, making sure that their programs are environmentally responsive and not just get the aid in as quickly as possible. So things are moving in that direction. But I think for humanitarians, the imperative is always help people first and worry about the environment later. And so it's kind of a mindset. And there, too, I think development actors have a lot to teach us. Abby, I share some of your concerns about the new buzzword of resilience. Sometimes it may be if this community were really resilient, they wouldn't have been susceptible to that landslide, rather than the responsibility of governments and others to make sure that people are safe and address the causes which may lead to a landslide. And there I think that the decision this week by the Italian courts of, you know, holding scientists and government responsible for failure to predict adequately an earthquake is sending shockwaves through many communities about these questions of responsibility.
Carrie?
And then one point I wanted to add on how we look after the ecosystems and biodiversity. At American Red Cross, we had a really strong partnership with the World Wildlife Fund in the aftermath of the 2004 tsunami. And that's, again, where we're able to work longer and go into that development spectrum after 3, 4, 5 years, and it gave us wonderful time to make sure that what we were doing, rebuilding livelihoods, rebuilding communities, was sensitive. And the kind of dialogue, the rich dialogue that comes about from working on the ground together and just having others bring out simple points that we didn't know, we developed a green toolkit as a result of that partnership with the World Wildlife Foundation. And you can't do it always. We should do it always. But it's nice to know that when the opportunity is there, we've really been able to seize it.
Roger, you want to come back on anything?
No, I think Beth made the key points.
Thank you. One final round. I think we can squeeze in the lady here, and then I'll come. Or let's start with you in the front since the microphone's there, and then get to you.
Thank you. Jose Frech from the Brookings Institute. From the discussion, I understood that there are three main causes for gentrification, which are man-made conflict, the environment, or state-caused displacement. Sorry, talking about displacement. But I haven't heard anything about gentrification. And in my opinion, like state-mandated displacement, gentrification is also done for purposes of development. The only difference is that in gentrification, it's the invisible hand of the economy causing the displacement. And in state mandated, it's by the state, right? So I would like to hear a bit more about, you know, the impact of gentrification, and if this is also accounted for in the studies in the aggregate numbers of displaced people. Thank you.
Thank you. The lady in the fourth row here, please.
Thank you. Ruth Berg, Calcutta Kids. Ms. Santos, you talked about the partnership between World Wildlife Fund and Red Cross. I'm interested to know, there are so many humanitarian organizations, and then there are government organizations in this country, for instance, FEMA. How do you coordinate so that you're not stepping over each other's toes or missing work that some other organization has already done? Thank you.
Thank you. Lady in the back there.
Hi, my name is Natalie Cornett. I'm a graduate student at GW, and my question is about involving community-based organization, especially in the humanitarian field. It's been kind of seen more in the development sphere, but how are humanitarian actors involving and engaging and working through CBOs, or how should they be working with them, especially in... We talked about that gap between the humanitarian and the development. And when the humanitarians leave and before the development projects come in, I think CBOs have a huge role to play in that transition. So I wanted to see if you could maybe talk a little bit more about that. Thanks.
One final question, if there is one. Not the case. Then let me turn one final round for you. So if you can both answer the questions and any final thoughts, maybe starting with Roger, ending up with Beth.
Let me start with the last question about involving local communities. I think I'd kind of slightly challenge you on that. I mean, not just simply because a lot of the report is precisely about that process and many practical examples of communities that are engaged in developing their own self-protection, for example. So it seems to me that there is already, I think, a very heavy engagement by humanitarian actors with community-based organisations, civil society organisations, I think, across the spectrum. I mean, I think lying behind your question is the concern that obviously in conditions of the immediate presentation of an emergency or the immediate aftermath, inevitably, humanitarian organizations, particularly international ones, are very highly geared. If they're prepared, they can move in very quickly, and there appears to be a kind of an implication that there's a kind of disempowering process that goes on there. But I think certainly from the work that I've done and seeing humanitarian actors acting, as well as I think a lot of the thrust of this report is really to challenge the notion that humanitarian intervention inevitably means a kind of sidelining of community interests and community-based responses. So I think there is good evidence, and I think the report points that evidence, not to say that, you know, there's not more work to be done, but I think there is quite a wealth of practice that's identified in the report. I think you're right, though, to say that there is a kind of vacuum, the vacuum when there's a kind of shift from the immediate aftermath of the emergency or disaster response to the kind of so-called early recovery phase, and that's sort of highlighted in the whole sort of cluster architecture of the Interagency Standing Committee and sort of when you shift to the development agenda. But I think the challenge there is really sort of reflecting back to my answer, I think, to the first question we had, that I think you're right, there is a gap there, and it's something that perhaps we don't really pick up on in the report sufficiently. If I could just talk a little bit about the kind of issue of gentrification, but maybe Beth will come in more on that. The report and the chapter specifically that we've been talking about doesn't pick up on that particular phenomenon or driver, if you like, within the broader context of development. I think you are right to highlight it. The challenge, I think, as Beth has already said, is that remarkably enough, that given that unlike displacement from disasters or emergencies, one should in fact be able to track data. One should in fact, you know, inevitably when displacement takes place, for example, there's a box in the report about the Metro Manila Railroad, and 35,000 households were part of a census. They were identified, enumerated, and resettled. You would think that you would be able to do that for all development projects because it is a planned process. And even in a sense where gentrification and urban renewal is taking place, you would think you would have data. Remarkably enough, it's almost impossible to get that data. And it's
the figure that we're working with is really quite a generic figure, and I suspect is actually much larger. The other question, I think, was the issue of how one manages the complexity and the large number of humanitarian organisations working together in the particular kind of context that we're talking about. Humanitarian coordination is a major challenge, and it's been highlighted from some of the really big sort of catastrophic displacement disasters like the Rwanda genocide, for example, onwards, from the mid-1990s onwards, and indeed before. Part of Chapter 7 addresses this in terms of looking at the governance of humanitarian intervention, the strengths and weaknesses of the cluster system, the Humanitarian Reform Review in 2005, the transitional review that is now, or transformative agenda as it's now called, to try and reshape particularly the cluster structure. The one challenge, I think, and one of the issues that we do mention here is that much of the reform and the review of the structure of international humanitarian intervention is really driven by intergovernmental actors and engagement with non-governmental organisations and international organisations like the IFRC. That, I think, is still a weakness in the kind of reform and review processes that are taking place within the governance of the humanitarian regime.
Thank you, Rhonda and Carrie.
Sure. On the very specific question about how American Red Cross works with FEMA, it's not my specialty. I'm an international expert, but I do know that in the United States there's a national response plan that's developed by the U.S. government. The U.S. government are the authorities who are responsible for ensuring that there aren't gaps in assistance, that everybody's working well together. There's a huge community domestically, VOLADs we call them, the voluntary organizations that work together week in, week out, month in, month out, when there isn't a disaster, to try to make sure that the lines of communication are there, that everybody understands each other's methods. It's obviously not perfect. I think the Hurricane Katrina exposed for us some of the gaps in how we work together. There's been a lot of effort to try to work on those things that came out during Katrina and improve it. Always the next disaster highlights new things we hadn't predicted, but I think there's a strong impulse in the domestic U.S. community to work on coordinating better and making sure that the responses are better, also driven at the local level. That's the principle of U.S. response, that the local authorities have precedence, and it's only when things get elevated that you bring in the state, or in much rarer circumstances, the federal authorities. And then going to the question of involving community actors and community participation and planning, it is, of course, difficult in the fog of a disaster or a conflict to organize quickly and have dialogues with communities, and that's why we work on this during disaster preparedness. That's a huge investment in the Red Cross overall, but a lot of peer organizations do the same thing, where we dialogue now with communities. We ask communities now to tell us, what are your priorities? What do you want to fix in your community? How do you want to mitigate your environmental risks from the landslide or the mudslide? We do this when there isn't a crisis. Communities can organize themselves, develop councils, develop links with their local governments, their national governments, and then we cross our fingers when the next big thing happens. Those structures, the practice of sharing and collaborating should be there. And I think we do see success stories over, you know, 2-3 decades of disaster preparedness work, that it does start to work. There's a great deal more to be done. Donors don't like to invest in disaster preparedness, but it's a large priority for Red Cross, Red Crescent Movement, and for American Red Cross to invest in that early work, which saves us all lives and money down the road.
Thanks. On this question of gentrification, I think it shows us there's still a lot of gray areas. You know, traditionally, a migrant is somebody who voluntarily chooses to go someplace else. I went to Geneva. You're a migrant worker in Geneva. Whereas those who are displaced, there's an element of coercion. You know, I'm forced to. It's But in practice, it isn't always so clear. Gentrification, urban renewal projects, sometimes you're forced, you have to leave, you're evicted. And sometimes you can't live there anymore for economic reasons. So there are gray areas there that I think that looking at some of these issues around housing and shelter and urban areas brings to the fore that need to be addressed. Community-based organizations usually are there before the disaster happens, after the disaster happens. Most lives saved are saved by members of the community, not by international organizations, which simply take too long to get there to pull people out of the rubble and earthquakes, for example. I think the best coordination mechanisms are those that include those community-based organizations from the beginning, and very few of them do.
Thank you, Beth. I know we've run out of time, but Josephine, as you could see, was just whispering into my ear. And Josephine, by the way, is the staff person who has helped bring about the last four editions of this report, so is the other person next to the editor doing most of the work, has just reminded me that we've had an online following of this discussion and lots of tweets. I don't know if anything has come out of that that we should quickly comment on. Is that at the back?
No.
Okay, then let me, before saying the final thank yous, leave you with one or two thoughts, if I may. The first one is I'd like to come back to Roger's opening remarks in terms of the cover picture, which was chosen deliberately to bring across the message that we're not talking about victims and objects here. We're talking about people who have their own dignity and their own capacity to bring about change. And I hope that this discussion reflected that, and that this discussion also reflected that in principle we know what's right to do. It is about investing into these people and their capacities to bring about meaningful change, and it is about in influencing others who can help create conducive environments for those kinds of investments to happen and be meaningful. And the second thought, sort of related, is in the launches in Europe, there was a lot of talk about hardening of minds also on state sides. And it was interesting, we in the Brussels launch event, we had the European Community Commissioner for Humanitarian Work, Mrs. Georgieva from Bulgaria, with us. And she was speaking as the EU had just been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And she said that is an obligation, that Peace Prize, to go about working with issues such as forced migration in a dignified and peaceful manner. Now, the U.S. as a country hasn't received a Peace Nobel Prize, but I believe your president has. And I think lots of the questions that were raised here suggest that there's as much concern about this as there is in Europe in terms of dealing with this issue in a dignified and peaceful manner. Let me thank all of you for coming, for your interest, for the people who were online and followed us and may have tweeted around the world. Let me thank Beth again, and through her, the Brookings Institute, for hosting us here today. Thank you to the four of us, the three panelists, for this discussion. And finally, let me thank again the people who've worked behind the scenes. I've already noted that Beth is one of the chapter authors, Roger for the tremendous job in editing all of these various inputs, and my colleague Josephine for being the tireless worker in the background.